Hi everyone, and welcome to our 20 Lessons podcast. Today, we're going to talk about Shabbat, one of Judaism's most celebrated rituals and practices, specifically the Friday night dinner, the Shabbat dinner. It's when we experience that warmth and sense of family sitting around a dinner table. But obviously, and as we'll see soon, Shabbat is much more than just a weekly family dinner. And that's really what I want to talk about tonight. Many people around the world have family dinners, but Shabbat dinner, Shabbat, is something far more. So the Kuzari, a very early work on Jewish philosophy, and a very important work on Jewish philosophy, the Kuzari, which we can talk about another time, it introduced the world to the tells us that Judaism, or explains to us, points out that Judaism introduced the world to the universally accepted seven-day week. And the culmination of that week for the Jewish people is Shabbat, Friday night and Saturday. It's a day of rest, a day to connect to God. It's a day of rejuvenation. Now, other religions subsequently adopted the Shabbat idea by taking a day off every single week. And if you fast forward to today, and when we have this intense electronic connectivity, some even have adopted a secular Sabbath or a tech Sabbath to kind of insulate themselves from the ever-present media that surrounds us. It penetrates every aspect of our lives. So different forms of a Shabbat have evolved over time. And the question that I want to first talk about is, why don't we just enjoy? Why doesn't Judaism just enjoy a restriction-free secular Shabbat? Everyone can determine the parameters of what best suits them based on their particular needs and schedule in order to get the break that they need, right? So you can have a doctor maybe will take off one day, a barber will take off another day. And of course, if something pressing comes up one week, you'll go in the office and you'll take off an extra day the next week. And that would seem to all make a lot of sense. Give us the rejuvenation, give us the breather that we require. Why is it that the Jewish people are so dedicated to when and how to observe Shabbat? Obviously, it's more than a day off. It's more than a family dinner. There's got to be something quite powerful about Shabbat to have prompted those famous words of Echad Ha'am, who he himself wasn't a religious person. He's a founding father of cultural Zionism. That was his pen name, Echad Ha'am, who penned those very well-known words. More than the Jews have kept Shabbat, Shabbat has kept the Jews. What is it? There's an inherent power in the rituals of Friday night and Shabbat that has been able to keep the Jews and has allowed Shabbat to become our most central Jewish practice. And to introduce these thoughts, I just want to share a quick story. A poor man once came knocking on the door of a chassid, of a Hasidic man living in Europe in the early 1900s, asking for charity. And the chassid didn't have any money to give the man. But he did notice that his wife's gold ring was lying on the table. He decided that the man's situation was so desperate that it warranted giving him his wife's ring. He consulted with his wife and she agreed, "We should give this man the ring." Shortly afterwards, the chassid's wife became frantic and she ran outside trying to find the poor man. Now, immediately the chassid thought, "I did wrong. I should never have presented her with this dilemma in the first place. I forced her into this. I pressured her into this." And he started running after his wife, apologizing, promising her that he would earn enough money to buy her a new ring, asking her, "Just allow the poor man to keep the ring. I promise you I'm going to buy you a new ring." To which their wife responded and said, "That's not why I'm chasing after the man. I'm afraid that he doesn't realize the full value of the ring. And in his desperation for cash, he might sell it for much less than it's worth." And that's the risk that we run when we think of Shabbat as just another day off or just another family dinner. So let's delve into these very special rituals and practices, mitzvot and meaning that make up Shabbat. And I think we're going to get a much bigger picture. So the centrality of Shabbat to Judaism is reflected in the Torah by its inclusion in the Ten Commandments, right? It's one of the Ten Commandments to keep the Shabbat. In fact, and we know that the Ten Commandments are repeated twice. They're stated twice in the Torah. And each time, Shabbat is actually introduced with a different word, which tells us a lot about Shabbat. The first time it's introduced with the word zachor, to remember. Zachor de'um ha-shabbat l'kadosho, remember the Shabbat to make it holy. And the second time, it's introduced with the word shamor, safeguard. Safeguard the Shabbat to make it holy. So what's the remember? What's the safeguard? So what our sages tell us is that safeguarding speaks to certain prohibitions, to a negative commandment that require us to honor the Shabbat by refraining from certain types of labor, which the Torah refers to as milacha. We're just going to translate it for labor now, but we will get a little bit more into it. So to refrain from certain forbidden labors and any practices that would diminish the holiness of the day, even if they do not fall under the categories of one of those forbidden labors, there are other practices that could also diminish the sacredness, the significance of the day. And it's these forbidden labors, this idea of refraining from the 39 categories of forbidden labor, that is often difficult to understand. So let's just first talk about what it means, the 39 categories of labor. So the Torah tells us that there are 39 categories of work that are forbidden on Shabbat. Now, how do we learn? Where do we know about these 39 forbidden categories on Shabbat? Well, they're derived from the proximity of the Torah verses that describe the building of the Mishkan. The Mishkan was the temporary tabernacle, was this holy temple, some version of a holy synagogue that the Jewish people would erect and take down when they were in the desert, and it accompanied them throughout the entire journey through 40 years through the wilderness. That's the Mishkan. And the Torah describes the building of the Mishkan, how to build it and how to maintain it. And right next to the verses that describe the building of the Mishkan is the obligation to observe the Shabbat. So the proximity of those two verses basically teach us that which forbidden labors is it? What does it mean to observe the Shabbat? It's to keep away, it's to refrain from engaging in those 39 forbidden labors, the 39 labors that go into building the Mishkan. Those are the labors that you have to refrain from doing on Shabbat. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit of, there's a deeper logic to that. What is the connection between the Mishkan and Shabbat? Well, if you think about it for just a moment, when God created the world, God created the world for 6 days and then rested on the seventh, rested on Shabbat. Hence Shabbat, the day of rest. Now, God was creating the human world during those, or our physical world during those 6 days and then rested. When we were building the Mishkan, when we were building the tabernacle, what we were doing was building a little dwelling place for God within our physical world. And we spent all that time on it. So when we talk about resting from certain labors, it would make sense that we would rest from those very labors that mirror the labor that God engaged in as God was building our world. What mirrors God's building our world? Us building God's dwelling, which is the Mishkan. And just as God rested after 6 days from building, so when we rest after 6 days, it would be from what we were doing to build the dwelling place for God. Hence, it's those 39 labors that went into building the Mishkan that we are commanded to refrain from on our Shabbat. Now, some of those 39 labors are quite obscure, and it's not as simple to point out how that they impact on our weekly lives, but some of them are not obscure at all. I'm going to share with you about a third of them, maybe 16, 17 of them, that come up on a very regular basis. So you have plowing, reaping, kneading, sowing, Planting, I'm sorry. Gathering, baking, obviously baking, cooking, those are not, that's a very relevant one. Hotsa'a, which is carrying or moving an object from one domain to another. So this is the idea that on Shabbat, one, you're not allowed to carry an object within a public domain or from a private domain into a public domain. And you may see observant Jews carrying on Shabbat outside in the middle of the road. How do they do that? That is because of an Eruv. What is an Eruv? An Eruv is a is a set of wires that act as walls, that act as walls that basically can transform a public domain into a private domain, and then the carrying that you're doing is in a private domain, and that is completely permitted. Like just like we can carry within our own homes, we can carry within an apartment building, so we also are able to carry within an Eruv. And many cities in the world that have a decent sized Jewish observant population have an Eruv to allow the carrying on Shabbat. A couple of other forbidden labors are slaughtering and building and extinguishing and turning on a flame, turning on a light. That's where we get turning on a light, electricity from, tying a knot, demolishing, sewing. All of these different forbidden labors, and at first it seems quite complex and overwhelming, but as you begin to experience Shabbat and these observances on a weekly basis, eventually they become natural, and you inevitably will find a transformation take place in your weekly life. Anyways, so that's a couple of other ones, are writing and erasing, many different forbidden labors. Now, what's interesting is that, and I think the best way to point this out is by sharing a quick story. I'm going to read it to you from a very fascinating book called Gateway to Judaism by Rabbi Mordechai Becher. And this is a little anecdote that he shares. I once spent Shabbat at the Holiday Inn in Kowloon, Hong Kong, where I was given a room on the 11th floor of the hotel. I did not use the elevator because of the Shabbat restriction against turning electric circuits on or off. So instead, I used the staircase designed for the staff. Wheezing and staggering up the 10 flights of stairs, I encountered a waiter at the hotel who asked me why I was not using the elevator. I replied, because it is the Shabbat, our day of rest. We looked at each other for a moment. He nervously smiled and sped away before I could explain how climbing 11 flights of stairs is considered rest. And that's one of the most asked questions. Rabbi, I live an hour and a half walk away from the synagogue. How could you possibly tell me that walking to synagogue is more in fulfillment of Shabbat as a day of rest than getting into my car and getting to the synagogue within 10 minutes? And obviously, the obvious response is that when we talk about forbidden labors and resting from labor, we're not talking about resting from work. We're not being told to sit in a hammock all day and rest in that sense of the word. Interestingly, this idea of resting from work was a totally new institution in human history. And at first, no other culture could understand it. And what was it that they couldn't understand? Because really, every religion had its holy days, but none before had ever had a day whose holiness was expressed in the prohibition of certain forms of work. Greek and Roman writers ridiculed the Jews because of this. Some of the most famous of them, Seneca, and Tacitus, they referred to the Jews as a lazy people who took a day off because they did not labor. Greeks or Romans, these great philosophers, they couldn't understand the idea that rest is an achievement. And I think there's a lot to be said about this on this topic. What is it exactly that we are resting from, and why are we resting from it, and what is the goal of Shabbat's rest? And there's a lot to be said about it, and I just want to share a couple of ideas. The first thing to point out is that what the Torah forbids on Shabbat is what it refers to as melacha. Malacha does not mean work. It's exactly the same language that's used to explain or to describe God's creation of the world. God did malacha in order to create the world. And obviously that doesn't mean physical exertion or work, because obviously God doesn't work. God is infinite. God spoke and the world came to be. So we're obviously talking about not resting from physical work per se, but rather something much different. So the first obvious idea that comes to mind is that this is our way of testifying, declaring every single week that we believe as God is our creator. God worked for 6 days and then rested. God created the world for 6 days and then rested. We work on the world for 6 days, and then in proclamation or in declaration of God as our creator, we rest as well. So that's the first idea to share. The obvious question on that, of Shabbat being a day in which we testify to God creating the world, God is our creator, I've heard asked in such a brilliant way as follows. Let's say that you are a part of a city council, and the city council is getting together because they want to celebrate something. They want to create a day of celebration, a day to honor Rosa Parks, right? And they decide they're going to do it on the day that Rosa Parks courageously resisted the racist policies of her time. She refused to get up from her seat for a white person. And the city council has to decide, how are we going to properly honor and celebrate Rosa Parks Day? So, of course, many in the city council would get up and say, why don't we have everybody sitting in the front of the buses, keeping the back of the buses completely clear? And yeah, it may be hard for traffic and it may be hard for other things, but this would be a very clear declaration. It'll be a very clear way to honor what Rosa Parks, her courage, her bravery, and her accomplishments. Maybe something along those lines. Something that would recall what it was that made Rosa Parks so heroic, what shows Rosa Parks' courage. But then all of a sudden, there's a guy at the back of the room. And this guy says, I have an even better idea. The way that we should honor Rosa Parks Day is, instead of having everybody get up onto the buses, we should actually have everybody go home and take a nap. Because Rosa Parks, after courageously standing up for her for equality, she was exhausted. And she went home and she took a nap. So we should all take a nap. That's how we should celebrate Rosa Parks Day. That's how we should honor that day. Now, obviously, that sounds ludicrous, but when you think about it for just one more moment, this is really, according to what I'm saying right now, this is really what it seems Shabbat is all about. This is what it seems that we're doing on Shabbat. We're trying to recall God as the creator, and the way that we recall or declare God as the creator is by resting, because eventually God took a rest from the creation. That doesn't seem to make much sense. There's got to be more. It's got to be about more than just acknowledging God as our creator. There must be something that is inherent in the resting that we are commanded to do that will make all of the difference. And the question is, what is that? So I think the first thing to point out is that, think of an inventor. An inventor builds a machine, and this machine maintains itself fully. It fuels itself. It oils itself, right? So we have this machine, and it fuels itself, it oils itself, it cleans itself. And that is very clever. But that machine is only meaningful if it produces something useful. A machine whose only output is its own maintenance would be absolutely ridiculous. And perhaps that's the first idea that we can share about Shabbat. I want to share two ideas. This is the first idea that we can share about Shabbat. We maintain and we maintain and we build and we create and we maintain ourselves all week for 6 days. We make money to support our families. We make money to support ourselves. We eat and we drink and we get up in the morning and we have this constant routine of maintenance, of creating, of building. And the problem is that if our entire life is just about maintaining, then that is just like that machine that just maintains itself, maybe clever, but it's absolutely ridiculous. And what Shabbat does is it reminds us of the angle. It reminds us of the end point. It reminds us of the purpose of all of that entire process. Why are we doing all of this? Why are we spending an entire 6 days on maintaining, on building, on creating, on feeding, and on drinking? Why are we doing all of this? There's got to be something more. There's got to be something more significant. There's got to be an angle here. And it's what we focus on Shabbat that allows us to take a break from everything that we engage in during those 6 days, and instead to focus on why are we engaging in any of that in the first place, in order to reacquaint and rejuvenate and recalibrate so that we can keep our eyes on the ball and not lose sense and not lose track of our priorities throughout the entire week. We're doing this, these 6 days of work, for certain reasons, because of certain priorities. Let's not forget that. And if we would just continue with 7 days every single day going through this maintenance, we would completely lose sight of our priorities. So on Shabbat, we focus right in on our priorities, and we don't do anything creative. We don't do any maintenance work, which is really what the 39 forbidden labors are all about. It's maintenance work. It's all of these things in which we manipulate the world in order to provide for ourselves, in order to maintain ourselves. And on Shabbat, we take that break so that we can recalibrate, focus on our priorities, and then the next week, come in rejuvenated that we're doing all of this. This is purpose-driven. And what's the purpose? It's all the things that we focus on Shabbat. It's our relationship with others. It's our relationship with God. And it's our relationship with ourselves. That's the first idea I'd want to share. Now, I want to get a little bit more into this now. This is the second idea I want to share. I'm only going to share two ideas for now because this is more of a survey podcast. We can definitely speak for hours just about what rest on Shabbat is. But this is the second idea I want to share. The second idea I want to share is that melacha, that Hebrew word melacha, appears 200 times in the Torah, and it never once refers to physical labor. Rather, what melacha really refers to, and it's Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, the great rabbi of the 1800s, the great German rabbi of the 1800s who lived in Frankfurt, who single-handedly, with his writings and his oratory, he stemmed the tide of assimilation that was going on in Germany at that moment in time amongst the young people. He points out that every one of those 200 times points to a very specific idea that melacha is referring to, that this quote-unquote forbidden labor is referring to. What melacha is, it's the execution of an intelligent purpose by the practical skill of humankind. In other words, it's the creative development of the physical world, a production creation or transforming an object for human purposes. It has nothing to do with physical exertion. So now, why is it that it is that specifically? It's this creative development of the physical world that God tells us to take a break from? Because that's exactly what Shabbat is. Shabbat creates a sanctuary in time in which we take a break from creative development of the physical world, because it's creative development of the physical world, creative action, building, tweaking, constructing. That's how we show mastery over our world. And as we show mastery over our world, we are basically emulating God. And we can very easily come to this point where we think of ourselves as godly. It's as we engage in these very specific creative actions that we begin to accept the illusion of things being completely under our control. But the reality is that though that is just an illusion. And the better that we can shed this illusion, the more deep and healthy and meaningful our lives will be. The more humility we will have, the more serenity and calm we will have, the less anxious we will be, the more focused on true priorities we will be. And once a week, we are told to actively relinquish this control that we must show over the world, the mastery that we show over the world. If a business deal is going bad, we don't deal with it. A light goes out, we don't turn it back on, in order to remind us, in order to recalibrate us, that we are not in complete control. Because it's only when we come to that realization, to that headspace of us not being in control, that is God. And there are things that are under our control, and there are things that we can respond to very well, but it's only if we really understand. And the only way that we'll get to that real understanding and realization is if we spend the day where we can focus on that, where we can experience that, It's only then that we are reacquaint ourselves with reality, a reality that can strengthen who we are, that can strengthen our relationships with others and with God, and give us a grounding, the grounding that we all so desperately need. So that is a little bit about the refraining from forbidden labor, which is really all about refraining from creative action that shows our mastery over the world on Shabbat. And that's a little bit about the Hebrew introduction of the word shamor, safeguard the Shabbat. It's all about honoring the Shabbat by refraining from action that takes us away from the headspace, from the Shabbat headspace. And then that brings us to the other way that we introduce Shabbat, the first time the Ten Commandments are written. And that is the Hebrew word zachor, which means to remember, to recall the Shabbat, to remember the Shabbat, to think of it with significance and sincerity, to understand it as a day that's completely different than any other day. Remember the Shabbat to keep it special. And that brings us to much of what we do to make Shabbat special, which focuses, which actually revolves around, a lot around the Shabbat meals, which there are three, and specifically the Friday night meal, which is known as Shabbat dinner. So let's focus on this for a bit. Now, of course, like anything else that is special, it all begins on how we prepare for it. So it's no surprise that Maimonides, in his monumental work on Jewish law, explains that you don't just go into Shabbat and expect the uplifting nature of it to just wash over us. Rather, the Rambam, Maimonides, codified that what is meant by honoring Shabbat, which is a mitzvah for us, I'm going to read it to you. The sages explained that honoring the Shabbat is declaring that each person should wash his face, wash their hands and their feet with hot water on Friday in honor of the Shabbat, and wrap themselves in a garment and be seated with dignity in the expectation of the Shabbat, receiving it as if you were coming out to meet royalty. The ancient sages used to assemble their disciples on Friday, put on their best clothes, and say, "Come, let us go out to meet King Shabbat, Queen Shabbat." And so it begins with the preparations. And then we usher in the Shabbat as we light the Shabbat candles. Why do we light Shabbat candles? So as I've explained already, we're obligated to delight in the Shabbat. And that is through the enjoyment of God's physical world on Shabbat, most significantly through food. And of course, even the finest cuisine becomes a drab affair when you can't see the colors, textures, and forms of these delicious foods. Human beings are visual creatures, and our ability to derive pleasure from food is very much tied up to our visual experience. So as Jews, we want to recall the Shabbat, a day of delight, in the word of our prophets. So you had to have a lamp lit for the nighttime meal. And obviously it had to be lit beforehand, because we're told specifically that we cannot create a fire on Shabbat. And that's how the first Shabbat candles came about. It was in order to make sure that we were delighting in the Shabbat as best as possible. At some point in history, oil started to become more expensive, and people stopped lighting up their homes for Shabbat. And this meant gone was the delight we were supposed to experience. Furthermore, sitting in a dark home on Shabbat creates other problems. Shabbat is meant to be a day of peace and harmony. If you have a dark house with people tripping over every unseen obstacle and falling all over each other, that is not conducive to the peace and harmony that Shabbat engenders. So for the sake of delighting in the Shabbat, but also for the sake of shalom bayit, peace and harmony in the home, a distinct requirement was created that every home must have a lamp lit before Shabbat in every room where people may walk, where people may come into. That is when the obligation to light Shabbat lamps came into being. In this day and age, all of the other lamps can be replaced with electric lights, but that are of course turned on before Shabbat, or this is a topic, discussion for another time, but or they can go on with using a timer on Shabbat. We just can't manually turn on an electric light on Shabbat. But the principal lamp, the one that shines over the Shabbat meal, that must still be done by a burning flame. And that is the Shabbat candles. So what we end up really seeing is that the Shabbat candles are about delighting in Shabbat and also all about shalom bayit. It's about peace and harmony in the home. The rabbis obligated atmosphere lighting thousands of years before it became a thing. But lighting Shabbat candles also has one other important reminder to us. There's a something about a candle that makes it hover between the line of the physical and the metaphysical and the spiritual. And one of those things that make it seem more spiritual and physical is that a physical substance, when spread, it becomes thin. Whereas spiritual things, spirituality, when it spreads, it expands and grows. When you use something physical, it's diminished. So the more money you spend, the less you have. The more gas you use, the more empty your tank becomes. The more food you eat, the more you need to restock your pantry. But spiritual things increase with use. If I use my, or metaphysical things increase with use. If I use my wisdom to teach, the student now has that wisdom and I come out wiser for it as well. If I share my love with another, that person now has more love and I become more loving, not less. When you give a metaphysical gift, a spiritual gift, the recipient gains and you lose nothing. And that's a spiritual property that candles share. When you use one candle to light another, the original candle remains bright and also brightens up the next candle. And that's really an important thought to keep in mind as we go into Shabbat. Because we've just spent the entire week focused on the physical, which means that we've spent the entire week spreading ourselves too thin, because that is the nature of physical. That's the nature of engaging in the physical. We if things diminish, we spread ourselves very, very thin. But now, as we enter Shabbat, we're entering the sphere of the transcendent, the sphere of the spiritual, a sphere in which our giving empowers us and our engagement makes us stronger. That is what Shabbat is all about. And that is the reminder of the Shabbat candles as we enter this different realm in our existence. So, Shabbat candles, properly delighting in Shabbat, enhancing shalom bayit, peace in the home and harmony in the home. And number three, we are about to enter a different experience, a time of rejuvenation where we can tap into the transcendent and we'll feel strengthened as we engaged instead of what we usually feel, being spread too thin. Okay. Now, interestingly, the Shabbat candles are known as one of the mitzvot that are unique to women. Now, before we talk about why it's one of the mitzvot unique to women, which again is another class on its own, I do think it's important to explain that Shabbat candles are a woman's mitzvah, but really everyone's mitzvah. So if there's no woman of the home, then a male still needs to light Shabbat candles. Or if there's a woman of the home, but she's away from the home for Shabbat, even if she's lighting where she is, a male needs to light the Shabbat candles in that home. So yes, this mitzvah does fall on a woman, but certainly if there is no woman in that home for Shabbat, then a male has the obligation to light Shabbat candles. And we think about, why would this be a woman's mitzvah? And truthfully, again, I'm not going to get very much into it, but I think it's safe to say that with this light, it's all about creating harmony, shalom bayit. It's all about creating that peace and harmony in the home. And I think the light creates harmony in ways or in those very areas where it's safe to say that a woman's intuition and sensitivity are of the most important factors in creating harmony in the home. That's, again, a topic for another time, but I think that that's basically the idea. What the Shabbat candles accomplish is really works in tandem or works in correlation with the uniquely feminine inspiration and impact that can be had on the peace and the harmony in the home. Okay. So another interesting thing, right before Shabbat candles are lit, is to give some coins to charity before kindling the Shabbat candles. The practical reason for this is that on Shabbat, we're not allowed to handle money. So we're giving extra charity before Shabbat, so to make up for the charity that we can't give on Shabbat. The spiritual, there's a deeper reason though, and that is to remind us to consider the needs of others, even, and perhaps most especially, during our greatest spiritual moments. Now, when exactly do we light the Shabbat candles, and when does Shabbat start? So you may have heard of the idea of the 18 minutes. What is this all about? So strictly speaking, Shabbat begins at Shkia, which is Hebrew for sundown. So exactly at sundown, Shabbat begins, and from that point on, it is forbidden to perform the forbidden labors of Shabbat, including lighting Shabbat candles. And when we talk about 18 minutes, that is this idea that we light Shabbat candles 18 minutes before sundown. Why do we light it before Shabbat, so far before Shabbat begins? Obviously, we need to light it before Shabbat begins, because you're not allowed to light candles on Shabbat. But why so far before Shabbat begins? So the Torah employs certain language regarding Yom Kippur. And it's based on that language that the sages of the Talmud learned that just like on Yom Kippur, there is a mitzvah to add a few moments to the beginning of Yom Kippur and to the end of Yom Kippur, so too is it for Shabbat as well. And this is called Tosefet Shabbat, adding time onto Shabbat. And according to many, this is a biblically mandated obligation. And what is the idea of bringing Shabbat in early and having it last a couple of minutes after nightfall, 25 hours after it began at sundown the night before? So, of course, bringing Shabbat in early and having a couple of extra minutes at the end will ensure that we don't accidentally miss the start time and perform or end time and perform forbidden work on Shabbat. Furthermore, it obviously demonstrates our affection for the Shabbat. We go out to receive the Shabbat even before it arrives, and we accompany it out when it comes time for Shabbat to leave. And there's a lot more to it. We're not going to get into it right now. So based on this obligation of Tosefet Shabbat adding on to Shabbat, different communities have different customs as to how much time to add on to Shabbat. But the prevalent custom, especially in North America, is to light the Shabbat candles 18 minutes before sunset. It as a way to fulfill this obligation to add on a little bit of time before Shabbat. Now, where do the 18 minutes come from? Well, in Talmudic times, it was the custom to blow 6 shofar blasts before the onset of Shabbat. 3 blasts would be blown to tell the people it was time to light Shabbat candles. Afterwards, they would then wait 18 minutes and then blow the final 3 blasts, which would indicate the onset of Shabbat and that all work was forbidden. And that was an 18-minute interval. And that would seem to be where we have the most prevalent custom of lighting the candles 18 minutes before sundown. Just interestingly, both in Jerusalem and in Brooklyn, and maybe other areas as well, this custom of the shofar blast has continued, but instead of shofar blasts, now you have sirens that are that siren that go off throughout the city to remind its inhabitants that Shabbat is coming. Okay, so candles are lit, and now we find ourselves in the synagogue for the most wonderful prayer service of the week, referred to as Kabbalat Shabbat, the prayer service of Kabbalat Shabbat. Kabbalat means to accept or to welcome in, the welcoming in of the Shabbat. These prayers have been legendary since their inception, 500 years ago. The poetry, the joyful melodies, some of the haunting melodies. They begin with the prayer L'chuna Ranana, which is translates as "Come, let us sing," followed by more expressions of song and thanksgiving and praises for God's glory. They begin with 6 major psalms of King David, chapters of Tehillim that makes up the bulk of the Kabbalat Shabbat services. They are celebratory and they correspond to the 6 days of creation. So it's almost as if we go through the 6 days of creation and then we culminate. We get to the 7th day of creation, and that is the masterpiece. That is the very highlight of the Friday night prayers, which we know as Lecha Dodi, which means come my beloved, come my beloved. The refrain of this song is come my beloved to meet the bride. Let us welcome the Shabbat. You see, in the 16th century, in the small town of Tzfat, located in the Galilee mountains in northern Israel, that became the center of Jewish mysticism, of Kabbalah. And Shlomo ben Moshe Halevi Alkabitz was one of the many mystics who lived and studied there. And on Friday nights, Alkabitz and his colleagues, they would dress in white like grooms, and they would joyously dance and march through the fields outside of town to greet the Shabbat and then to escort it into the city, which is depicted in both the Talmud and in the mystical text as a bride and as a queen. And in about the year 1540, Alkabitz, who was also a poet, composed the beautiful song, an ode to the Shabbat bride, Lecha Dodi, urging Jews to greet the Shabbat and extol her virtues. The poem quickly spread throughout the Jewish world. Within 100 years, was adopted and adapted by German Jews as a primary prayer for the Friday night service. Today, there are probably more than 1,000 musical settings for Lecha Dodi. It is a song or a prayer that's recited or sung in virtually every synagogue in the world as the Shabbat is ushered in. And in many congregations, when the final verse of the song is sung, and the words, enter, O bride, Boi Kala, enter, O bride, are said, those that are in the synagogue will turn to the entrance of the sanctuary and bow slightly in honor to welcome the Shabbat queen. Then the evening service concludes, and we now find ourselves back at home. The Talmud tells us that on Friday night, a person is escorted home from synagogue by two angels, one good and one not so good. When he comes home and he finds the candles burning, the table set, the beds made, the good angel declares, may it be God's will that the next Shabbat be the same. And to that, the not so good angel reluctantly answers, Amen. If the home's not prepared for Shabbat, the not-so-good angel proclaims, may it be God's will that the next Shabbat be the same, and the good angel then has to reluctantly answer, Amen. Obviously, this is not meant to make anyone feel pressured or harried, just to make sure that everything is perfect for Shabbat. The message of this cryptic passage is that the way we come into Shabbat will set the tone for the rest of Shabbat, which in turn can set the tone for the rest of the week. So before Shabbat starts, even if we just get home 5 minutes beforehand, don't just jump into it. Make some sort of small preparation. If you're not in the greatest mood, spend a moment trying to change that. Do something in preparation for Shabbat, and you will then see that you've began a trend that's blessed by the quote-unquote good angel who recognizes the efforts you've made. And anyways, the reason I'm telling you the story about the angels is because that's the story of the song Shalom Aleichem, which is, again, one of those extremely well-known songs that begins the Friday night dinner's prayer service before the dinner begins. It's four parts to it. Shalom Aleichem, or another tune perhaps. And what we do is we say Shalom Aleichem. We greet and then we bid farewell to the angels who accompanied us on Friday night and are now taking their leave. This liturgical poem as well was written by the Kabbalists of Tzfat in the late 16th century. And again, it's one of those things that has become almost universal, or perhaps universal. After Shalom Aleichem, we then sing a song that we refer to as Eshet Chayil. It's a poem written by King Solomon, and it's in praise of the Jewish woman. It may have even had more earlier source. The Midrash tells us that perhaps this poem was composed by our patriarch Abraham, written as a eulogy when his wife Sarah passed away. According to others, though, it was written by King Solomon to honor his mother, Queen Bathsheba, the wife of King David. And the basic concept is that at the conclusion of the week, every man takes a moment to reflect and be thankful for all that his wife or the woman of the home has done for him and the entire household throughout the past week. Indeed, the important Kabbalist, the Arizal, is known to have kissed his mother on both of her hands every Friday night, and some continue to follow that custom. It's a very special idea. Oftentimes people will recognize how lucky they are to have certain blessings in their lives. But Unfortunately, it's so rarely that we verbalize our feelings of gratitude. What's going on here is an obligatory verbalization to say thank you. It's an incredibly powerful tool towards enhancing a relationship, which then brings us to the next step, which is the blessing of the children. In many communities, it's customary for parents to bless their children before the Friday night meal begins. The parents place both hands atop the child's head and recites either, for boys, it's may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh, or for girls, it's may God make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. And then it goes into the priestly blessing. It's this magnificent custom to bless your child every Friday night because it's a moment that can be so filled with love and meaning. It's touching and it's healthy because no matter what conflicts occur during the week, at that moment, when you have your hands on your child's head, they cannot help but feel so special and so loved, really, which is really the building blocks of self-esteem. Again, our children, how often do we think about how lucky we are to have our children, but how not so often do our children get to experience the verbalization of how proud we are of them and how much we love them in a very focused one-on-one way. The rabbis mandated us to do so as we enter into Shabbat. So now we've lit our Shabbat candles. We've come home from shul. From the synagogue, we have said Shalom Aleichem. We've sang Eshet Chayil, the song to the Jewish woman. We've blessed our children, and now we get to Kiddush. Kiddush. What is Kiddush? Kiddush translates as sanctification or separation. What Kiddush is that's when we take a cup of wine before we begin our meal, and we make a declaration. And what is this declaration that we make? We say, tonight is different. Today is different. Shabbat is different. And the idea is that it's not just God that can create holiness. We too have that power. And when we recite the Kiddush, we are essentially partnering with God and bringing holiness to the day of Shabbat all by ourselves because we as human beings have that ability. What exactly are we doing? We're setting aside. The word Kiddush is the root of that word is kadosh, which means holy or set aside. We are recognizing, we are declaring that this day is set aside for something more meaningful. Kiddush is a meditation on the separateness of this day from all over the day of the week, and a meditation on all of the opportunities that this presents. And what's interesting is that we make Kiddush over a cup of wine. A cup of wine gives something significance, so it certainly gives the declaration that we are making significance. But what it also does is to recall that what Kiddush is sanctifying. Sanctifying, making holy, that's what Shabbat is about. It's about taking the mundane and elevating it to become holy. It's taking the physical and using it for such meaningful spiritual purposes. And think about everything we do over Shabbat. We eat lots of delicious foods, right? Why are we eating lots of delicious foods? Well, we're elevating that physicality, that what can be considered such physical stuff, and we're elevating it. And that's really what Judaism is all about. And that's what's so interesting on the fact that this act of holiness is done over wine. Wine, if you think about it, wine is one of those things that is physical, that can be misused in the most extreme ways. So much so that there are other religions that prohibit wine. But that's the entire point. The entire point is that there is nothing in this world that in its proper setting and context cannot be elevated and turned into something holy. And Shabbat has the power to take anything and make it holy. So we fill the Kiddush cup up and we say Kiddush over it. It begins with the words Yom HaShishi. On the sixth day, the heavens and the earth and all their hosts were completed, and God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, for on that day God rested from his malacha, from all of God's work. We testify to God being the creator of the world as well. Once we finish, we sit, we drink some of the wine, and we pour the rest of the wine into cups so that everybody around the table is also able to drink from the Kiddush wine. And after Kiddush, the next step is we wash our hands in the customary manner for eating bread. We do this anytime that we eat bread, but because there is an obligation to have bread, challah, which we'll get to in just a moment, on Friday night, then of course we begin with washing our hands. And we fill up a large cup, we pour it over our hands two or three times, right hand, then on the left hand. And then we make the special blessing that we say on the mitzvah of washing our hands before eating. And then that will bring us back into the dining room where we will make the hamotzi blessing, the blessing that we say before the before eating the bread, and then of course we'll cut the bread and we will eat it. What is washing our hands all about? Again, this is a part, would be a discussion on its own, but I just want to point out that eating is something that can be looked at as completely physical, completely animalistic, but in Judaism there's no such thing. Everything is meaningful, everything can be holy. And when we engage in acts of holiness, we wash our hands, we purify, we purify ourselves, we prepare ourselves by washing beforehand. So before we pray, we purify our hands. When the Kohanim, the priests in the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, before they would engage in the service, they would wash their hands, they would prepare their hands. So too, we symbolically wash our hands before we eat, because we are about to engage in something meaningful, something holy, not just an animalistic tendency. So then what is the bread that we use on Friday night and on Shabbat? We use the bread that's referred to as challah. What does the word challah mean? Challah does not mean bread. The halachic, or the definition of the word challah, is a reference to a specific mitzvah. Back in the times when the temple in Jerusalem stood, when you would make bread, you would take a little bit off of it and you would give it to a Kohen. You would give it to a Kohen, to one of the priests that would work in the Beit HaMikdash. There were different gifts that were given to the Kohen. This piece of dough that was taken off would be called challah. And any dough which was made was obligated in this mitzvah to give a little bit, to give the challah portion of it to the Kohen. When the temple was destroyed, we no longer had the biblical mandate to give this little piece of bread to the Kohen, which ended up being a lot of bread, because people make a lot of bread. You end up having, the Kohen would end up receiving a lot of bread, and it would end up being a very significant, wonderful way to sustain and to support the Kohanim who worked for us in the temple. Nowadays, the rabbis still instituted the practice of challah, of giving this piece of bread. However, we're not allowed to give it to the Kohen, because what's going on, the unfortunate thing is, we're all considered ritually impure, which again is a topic for another discussion. And therefore, the Kohen is not allowed to eat ritually impure challah, you know, that little piece of bread. So therefore, we don't do it in that way. Instead, what Jews do through the centuries is we knead homemade dough, then we separate a piece of that dough and we burn it as a way to symbolically commemorate this special mitzvah of giving a gift to the Kohen. So we still have the opportunity to fulfill this mitzvah in some sort of way. And it's that mitzvah, it's that little piece of bread that was called challah. So today, the soft, sweet, or maybe not so sweet bread loaves that we customarily eat at the Shabbat meal became known as challah, after the mitzvah that we are afforded when kneading and baking it. You'll also notice that it's two challahs. We use two challahs. We don't just use one challah. Why do we use two challahs? So perhaps it's because in the desert, every day when the Jewish people were wandering through the wilderness, every single day, a portion of manna would fall from the heavens to sustain the Israelites. On Friday, two portions, one for Friday and one for Shabbat, would fall. So it would be a double portion every Friday and on our Shabbat. So hence, when we have our bread on Shabbat, we have a double portion. We symbolically recognize this by having two challahs instead of one. Another interesting thing you'll notice is that we cover the challahs. Why do we cover the challahs? So there are two very interesting ideas. Number one, we just explained that the challah reminds us, symbolically stands there to remind us of how God miraculously sustained us in the desert, the manna. And the manna would be kept fresh every single morning. It was encased between a layer of dew on top and a layer in the bottom to preserve its freshness. So we envelop the challah between the cutting board, or under whatever is underneath it, the tablecloth, and the challah cover on top, reliving the manna miracle at our Shabbat meal. The other reason why we cover it is very interesting. It gets to the very heart of true sensitivity and thoughtfulness. And it's this idea that every single food has a special blessing that we make on it. There are basically five or six categories of blessings, and each food has a blessing that we make on it before we eat it. And the question is, let's say you have five different foods in front of you. How do you decide which food to make a blessing on first? And the idea basically is like, why does it make a difference which food we make a blessing on first? So it just teaches us all about consideration and thoughtfulness. But anyway, so generally the seven foods, so generally the way it would work is that bread, you make a blessing on bread, and then you don't have to make a blessing on any of the other foods, because blessing is such a staple. Blessing is such a foundational part of any meal. Once you make the blessing first on the bread, the hamotzi, and once you made that blessing, you don't make a blessing on anything else. On Friday night, we do something different because we start the evening with kiddush, with wine. So really, we're making the blessing on the wine before we make the blessing on the bread. And that is actually doesn't work in our usual hierarchy of blessings. So what we do is we cover the bread so that it doesn't feel bad that we're not making the blessing on it first as we usually would. And we show that type of thoughtfulness to the bread. And we see this throughout the Torah. We see this idea that we're asked to show thoughtfulness, or that it's praiseworthy to show thoughtfulness even to inanimate objects. Why? Because when we're thoughtful to inanimate objects, all that does is it allows us to exercise our thoughtfulness muscle. And therefore, when it comes to who we really need to be thoughtful to, fellow human beings, we've already, you know, we're already in that habit. So we just end up being as thoughtful as possible to everyone and everything. Okay, anyways. So we finally can eat from the challah. So we make the blessing, and now we eat from the challah. Just by the way, you'll find that we do not speak, we do not talk between washing our hands and making the blessing and washing our hands until we make the blessing on the bread and eat from the challah. Why don't we talk? Because it's really considered one long fulfillment of a mitzvah, and we don't want to interrupt between one long fulfillment of a mitzvah. Okay. And then we have our delicious meal filled with beautiful singing and conversation and perhaps words of Torah. And then we finish off with Birkat HaMazon, the grace after meals, which again is a discussion for a different time. The next morning is still Shabbat, right? So Friday night is an incredible part of our week, but Shabbat lasts for 25 hours from sundown on Friday until nightfall, which is 25 hours after sundown the night before, until nightfall on Saturday night. And what does the Shabbat day look like? I'm just going to quickly go through it because I'm realizing that this is getting long. But what Shabbat morning looks like is there are special Shabbat morning services. They're a little bit longer than usual because you have a full Torah reading. You read an entire Torah portion. And then when you read an entire Torah portion every week, you finish the entire Torah every single year. And we also add a special prayer service on Friday Shabbat morning, which is called the Musaf prayer service. You see, in some ways, our prayer service of today reflects the sacrificial offering services of the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. And on Shabbat, there would be an extra offering called the Musaf, which just means extra. So too, in our prayer service, we add a special extra prayer service to reflect or to symbolize or to continue in that trend of Shabbat having an extra service, just as it did in the Holy Temple in Jerusalem. We come home after services are over. You know, obviously, in synagogue and shul, after services are over, we have kiddush, which is a wonderful, wonderful tradition. It's a time for people to get together, for a community to really bond as a community, because everyone's there, everyone gets to chat, the kids are running around. It's just it's a beautiful, beautiful custom, and there's food, and it's just a wonderful way to build community. Whoever came up with that is just brilliant, and it's been part of the Jewish experience for hundreds of years. You have a Shabbat lunch, you say kiddush again. This night, you know, it's a second kiddush, and you do another hamotzi. You have another two challahs because you're supposed to have three meals with bread on Shabbat. So you have your Friday night, you have your Shabbat lunch, and then you have a time in the afternoon to relax, perhaps to learn some Torah, to spend time with family, to nap. However, whatever is most fulfilling, that's what Shabbat afternoon is there for you for. And then you have mincha, you have your afternoon service, and Shabbat it's a little bit different because you have a Torah reading. It's the only afternoon service during the week that has a Torah reading. And what you do is you begin to prepare for the next week. You read the first aliyah, the first section of the next week's Torah portion, next Shabbat's Torah portion. And then after that, you have what is referred to as su'udah shlishit in Hebrew, which means the third meal. In Yiddish, it's shalosh shudos. And it's the third meal in fulfillment of this idea that we're supposed to have three meals on Shabbat. in Kabbalistic literature, in the words of Jewish mysticism, this meal has a lot of power. It has an extreme significance, which we will talk about at another time as well. And then, of course, the meal is over, Birkat HaMazon, and you go into the evening service. And after the evening service, we usher out the Shabbat. We escort the Shabbat out with what we refer to as Havdalah. Havdalah, of course, is a magnificent ceremony made up of a initial paragraph of prayer, three blessings. The first blessing is on the wine. The second blessing is on the sweet-smelling spices. The basic idea is that we smell these sweet-smelling spices in order to give us a little bit of comfort as we have to leave Shabbat or Shabbat leaves us. And then we also have a third blessing, which is on a fire. A fire. And what we do is, after the blessing, we allow the fire to reflect off of our nails, the only reflective part of our body. And we basically reflect that light, the light of Shabbat, into ourselves for the rest of the week to sustain us for the rest of the week. We finish off with another blessing, and that is Havdalah, but it has beautiful tunes, and it could be a very powerful part of the Shabbat experience. So that's just a little bit about Shabbat. I'm seeing that this is we're at our hour. I hope this was helpful. Please, if you have any questions, and if you want to experience any part of Shabbat, just let me know. It truly is the secret to the eternity of the Jewish people. Take good care, and thanks for listening.